with children and, you know, having a job as a designer or a creative, yes, I think it is always hard to try and find clear headspace, you know, and be creative and find that space. And I took it for granted when before kids, like how easy it would have been to do that. It wasn't until there was some urgency placed on me and my time got more precious, I think, that I really truly took advantage of the time to actually like act on ideas.
Welcome to the Dadwell Podcast. I'm your host, Antonio Garcia. Dadwell & Company is an independent media project at the intersection of creativity and fatherhood. The Dadwell Podcast features makers, artists, musicians, authors, filmmakers, and designers who are raising the creative bar while simultaneously raising small humans. Today, I'm talking creativity and fatherhood with Creighton Berman. Creighton is a designer, illustrator, and facilitator with work often combining industrial design, design thinking, and sketchnoting. Creighton is also the founder and creative director of Manual, a home goods brand creating products for slow living. His design work is part of the permanent collection of the Art Institute of Chicago, and he was the first designer ever to use Kickstarter to launch a product. Creighton is dad to his two sons, ages 8 and 4. In this episode, Creighton talks about the importance of keeping creative tools visible and within reach, what it means to design within the reality of fatherhood, the value of involving your kids in tangible creativity, and what led him to take the entrepreneurial leap with an 18-month-old at home.
You referenced your parents and growing up in the burbs, and I grew up in Arlington Heights and had a similar feeling thinking about Javier and Amaya growing up in the city, and that they're going to be exposed to things that I just didn't see in the suburbs. I didn't see homelessness in the suburbs, and now Javier sees it often and asks about it, and we talk about things. And so I think this idea of exposure and just what you see, there's something to be said for where you came up and then the conscious decision you make about where your kids will come up. So I'd love to know more about your dad, about your own father and your relationship and how you'd characterize it.
Oh, wow. All right, we're diving in. I think on the first point, that's a super interesting one, because I think a lot about geography and like where I am and where I choose to be, and not to get existential, but you know, you only have a certain amount of time on earth. And the reality is you can really only live so many places. My wife and I have chosen to stay, you know, we moved to Chicago after college and we've stayed in Chicago ever since then. And I'm really happy with the decision. A lot of times it gets romanticized, the idea of like moving around and seeing the world and going wherever the jobs are. And there's obviously a lot of positive to that. The exposure you get to just cultures and cities and all that is really awesome and irreplaceable. But I think oftentimes like staying in a place gets looked down upon, but I think it's like tree roots. The longer you let that tree grow, the deeper the roots go. And for me, at least, like I love the fact that having been here like 16 years or 17 years, something like that, I know a lot of people now. And like I've got networks of folks that some are friends, some are just people I know and see once in a while. Like, but it's cool that I feel like tapped into a place and really feel like I can influence a place. And, you know, I think my kids see that. Like Emily and I and a bunch of neighbors started a farmer's market in our neighborhood a couple of years ago. And the only reason we felt confident enough to do that is because we'd been here exposed to what Chicago farmer's markets could be and what would be the version of that we would do in our neighborhood and try to create a central community point for our neighborhood, right? And because I've developed those roots, because we've been here, like that really, those kind of things. And same with obviously my business, doing design in the same place for a long time means I have a good sized network of folks that I know and I can talk to and friends and things like that. I guess the takeaway from all this is just intentionality. Like every place matters so much and what you contribute to the place or what you get from the place. And yeah, so for us, that's been the city. And I think signs are pointing to that's what it will be, is we're going to stay here in our North Side neighborhood. I mean, it's definitely not like hardcore urban. You know, we're not around high rises and it's not like we don't have nature in this neighborhood. So to me, it's sort of the best of both worlds. We do have a little backyard and we are next to a bunch of parks and there's a forest preserve like within walking distance. So it's not like my kids won't get access to open play, but they do get access to a lot of cultural things and diversity that growing up in the suburbs of Northern Virginia, where I grew up, I just didn't necessarily have the same exposure to. So I think that's the goal, at least that I would want for myself and my family. But yeah, no, I grew up in Northern Virginia, which is, in the suburb called Sterling, Virginia. I moved once in my youth and it was only like a few miles. And so I guess that's part of why my values are like staying in a spot and developing some roots and getting to know it. part of my desire to be in the city probably stems from the fact that, you know, this suburb had a lot going for it, but it had a lot that I didn't love as I got older. And it was just, you know, very much the classic exurb kind of thing. Like, we weren't really that close to DC. Like, before I had a car, there was no way for me to get there without my parents taking me, you know, and they didn't want to do that. Because DC in the 80s was like this mythically scary place, right? Whether it really was or wasn't. That's a separate topic. So, you know, we were, and then the other thing was this suburb was fast growing, right? Like, the fields that I would run around in and play in were subdivisions like years later. So there was a real, like, not that I was thinking about urbanism and things like that as a teenager, but I definitely was like, this is weird. Like, like, all these houses weren't even here 5 years ago. And now they are. And in that way, like, that's probably why I think a lot about the place I am. I mean, there's definitely no shade thrown on my parents for their choices. You know, my parents chose this area, I would assume, for work reasons. Like, they both were born in New York. My dad was born in Queens. My mom was born in Long Island. You know, they grew up just outside New York City. And then, yeah, they pretty much spent their entire, or have spent their entire adult lives in Virginia. Going more into the family side of things, though. So my dad's always run his own business. So that has been a huge influence on me. He's not into the design world. It sounds very generic to say it, but he's in computers. And literally, I mean, now he's focused on information security and things like that. But, like, literally his career has been computers, because in the 70s, he was building machines and had his own OS, you know, had a word processing program that he sold for a while, and then did different kind of software consulting and, you know, just anything throughout the computer world. You know, so we had computers in our home, you know, much earlier than all my friends. You know, the huge gray boxes where the green screen, the monochrome screen, was built into the big crazy box. Like, those kind of things we had throughout the 80s. And so that was kind of cool. But, you know, I mean, definitely, like, you know, the fact that he's run his own business, you know, through ups and downs, and he still works, you know, he's into his 70s and he's still a consultant, you know, doing his own thing, setting his own schedule. Like, that was hugely influential on me. You know, I always thought it was the coolest thing in the world to go to my dad's office. As from what I can recall and pictures I've seen, like, it was a pretty basic kind of office, but there was still something cool about, like, being in the place where my dad did his work and seeing the tchotchkes he chose to put on his shelves. Like, he was really into giraffes. So he had, like, all these giraffes around his office for some reason.
That's funny.
I don't know. And I think a lot, just as much as I think about geography a lot, I think about workspace a lot. My studios, over the past few years, you know, I've done a bunch of different things, from a shared workspace, kind of a storefront gallery kind of thing, to my own personal storefront gallery that was, you know, that's like two blocks from my house, to most recently I moved in sort of a third floor kind of like loft space that's shared with some people, but is semi-private. Throughout that, my kids have been in my studios and have spent decent amounts of time there. It's really cool to be able to, like, involve your kids and let them see what you do, especially when it's when it's somewhat interesting. Like, I think we're lucky as designers and creators that we do things that kids can understand, you know, at a certain level and can participate in, and you know, they can see that dad's making work and that dad's, you know, working on this product and making models, or, you know, he's drawing this stuff over here or whatever. And I think that's kind of cool. Like, I definitely went to my dad's work, but I didn't really understand what he was doing until years later. And I still don't talk about it that well, you know? So I just think that's kind of a cool thing that we can do now and give them that opportunity. And, you know, and they're not always paying attention. Like, you know, he might be like drawing and making zines, or he might be like, you know, playing Minecraft, but either way, like, he's there, which is kind of cool for me and for him. I think I'm just always kind of thinking about, like, the balance of being around. There's something kind of heavy about, like, only seeing your kids for a few hours a day, and it's mostly like rushing them through the morning or rushing them to bed. That's, like, super heavy on me. So any chance I get to kind of break that rhythm, I think, is really worthwhile. People talk about work-life balance, but I think I've reached a point where I kind of see it all as work-life mush. That comes with upside and downside for me. And the downside is obviously when, like, I feel like I can't get any work done and I feel like I'm not being the most present father. But the upside is there's times where I feel like I'm giving time to family and I'm getting work done and I'm doing it on my own schedule.
Those moments are, man, when they happen, you just feel like top of the world.
Totally.
I hashtag do have it all. Like, this is what, how am I doing this? I wanted to dig into a couple of different things that you're talking about. So it sounds like being exposed to technology, having computers in the house, like that's a very powerful thing, especially at a time when most kids would have to wait well into like a learning center at the school library before they'd get their hands on an Apple IIgs or something.
Right.
And you kind of have these things around. So I think exposure is a key feature of how fathers work can meet their kids. And
totally.
And then also the fact that, you know, your dad's running his own business and making his own schedule and just seeing that that's possible. You know, it's not right. like your dad punched a clock somewhere and did computer things, but did them for somebody else, I think is also really important and clearly gives you a little bit more confidence when you're going to strike out on your own. Because it's like, well, you know, dad did it and we didn't end up destitute. So it's
yeah.
possible.
Yeah. I mean, everyone's background is different, right? So even if he did punch a clock, like it would just have different influence, right? For me, like, yeah, that influence was independence. You know, he never worked for anyone else, like ever. Like he graduated from grad school and instantly started his own thing. And so, yeah, I mean, it definitely gives a sense of, I can do this. Cause yeah, you're right. Like my father did it. And yes, there were times where things didn't go well. Like I remember one year, like something went really wrong. And, you know, I remember my parents being real tense about it, but we made it through and everything's okay. So, I mean, I think I took the same thing forward into my own practice and it's been generally very, very successful for me, but there have been times there was, you know, where things just weren't. I made some mistakes, I made some assumptions, and they just did not land how I wanted them to. And there were tense times, you know, it's just like at home, like it's just the way it is, but we worked through them. And it definitely is a privilege to be able to work this way, you know, because not everyone feels like they have the safety net around them to allow them to take risks like this. And, mm-hmm. you know, even for me, sometimes I wonder if I've got the right kind of, you know, amount of savings or whatever, you know, compared to like other people my age. I don't feel like I could go another way. Like working for myself, working independently just feels such a part of my DNA that I just can't imagine myself being employable at this point, even though that's probably not a great attitude. But I think you're right though. Like I just do feel like there's certain times where the flow strikes and it really just feels like creatively and from a family perspective, everything is just flowing and going well. And I'm finding that like a couple days a week at home, a day a week out doing things in the city, and then a couple days in the studio. And I feel pretty good. I really like it.
You hit the nail on the head talking about being designers or makers broadly, you know, however you want to define those kinds of disciplines. We deal in tangibility. People pay us to make ideas and concepts, or we have our own ideas and concepts, and people pay us because we know how to make them real. Even a service, you know, it's still a tangible expression of an idea. And kids only deal in tangibility in their earliest development, right? Like,
right.
Like we were saying, like everything is black and white. Everything is physical. Like babies put objects in their mouth because that's how they understand the world. It's like, what does this taste like? You know? And so
right,
like,
right.
It's an interesting thing to do something for a living and be paid for it. And for your kids to go, oh, it's not exactly the same, but that's kind of like I build with Legos. Or like that's
right.
That's sort of like I paint pictures. And I think seeing that when you're really young is really powerful because it says, or at least presents, an alternative to what I think a lot of academics and school and sort of institutions want to promote, which is very different. It isn't dealing in tangibility. It's dealing in, you know, something else.
Right. Well, I was just reading something in the paper, you know, it's talking about high school and how our models of high school aren't necessarily serving the way people at that age learn best. And the extracurriculars that kids are doing at that age, whether it be sports or music or theater or, you know, debate or whatever, that's actually where they're getting the most learning done. My read on that was like, yeah, like it's project-based learning, right? It's like, you know, when you're doing a theater production, there's an urgency because you want to provide the best you can provide because there's an opening in a few weeks, you know, and your friends and family are going to see you. Mm-hmm. And so there's real performance, like legit performance that you want to perform your best. And, you know, a lot of school is not built that way, at least traditional, you know, Western schooling, like public schooling is built around, you know, reading and memorization and tests and quantification and things like that, which, you know, I guess my main takeaway is like, yeah, like the act that like of physically doing something and having a project you're working on and gauging when you think it's done. And just there's a lot to be gained from that. And I mean, I think a lot of education understands that now. And that's why you see this push towards things like STEM and things like that is, you know, it may not be the science technology part of it that necessarily is for everyone, but the idea of like setting your own project goals and creating and iterating and working together and things like that. I mean, that's transferable across hopefully anything you're going to do in your life. And my older son's done it for a while, but my younger son just recently has started like, you know, making zines because they see dad like make little comic books and things like that. So they, you know, first thing they do is they ask where the stapler is when they're in my studio and they grab some paper and they staple it in the middle and fold it in half and they just start working on things. And of course they can just draw on paper, but like there's something about when you fold it in half and you saddle stitch it And suddenly it's like, it's a book. For me, it changes everything. And suddenly you're just thinking in such a different way about what you're going to create and what you're going to put in there and how you're going to pace it. And, you know, I just love that they're like, what's the cover? What's the title going to be? Like, what's the story I'm going to tell? And it's just, and then at the end, they have this thing that they can hand to someone else. I just think that's really cool for them. And it really, I feel like that framework of a zine, like gives them a project, right? They know, you know when it's done, right? Because you filled the book, you know, and that's just super cool.
Yeah, it's very powerful to make something, you know, and they do it all the time, you know, with toys and different activities, but to make something and then have that something be of value to somebody else, there's like, that's an added layer of like, oh, I didn't just make this little model. I made this model and somebody thinks it's really cool or wants to hold it in their hand or pass it to a friend or whatever that is. I think it just, it elevates whatever was just made.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Like, I mean, sorry, just one more thing on that. So Henry, is big into like inventing things and drawing them up. And I swear it's not me pushing that. He just does it. And
I'm like, that sounds like you're
Yeah. I know. I'm sure it's my influence, but I swear I never wanted to be the dad that like, or parent that like over pushed, like, oh, you need to do what I do. You know, like he's definitely gravitated towards it, but he'd been doing these drawings like all last summer. I think he saw the format actually in his STEM class at his school, which is, you know, science, technology, engineering, math. It's like an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper turned on side. In the middle, you draw the thing. And then above it, you give it like a title of what it is. And then there's all these little boxes down the left and right side of like features. And it's almost like marketing copy. And some of it's like different features it could do. And he does he did like, I don't know, must have been like 30 or 40 of these things over a couple week period last summer. I guess this is where I definitely did like push into like Tiger Dad territory. I'm like, hey, let's make a zine out of that. So he was like, okay. So I was like, all right, you pick your favorite 12 or, you know, whatever the number of spreads that would fit. And then we like photographed them. And I just tossed them into InDesign real quick, just so it paginated them. And then we printed out like, you know, a dozen copies. And he like gave them out to friends, and he gave one to a STEM teacher. And he gave, my wife works at a design firm. She's an in-house chef there. And she somehow mentioned it to some of the people there that he was doing this. And they got really excited because, you know, they do a lot of book design there. So 8 people there asked for a copy. So he got to like print some more and staple them. And he just felt so thrilled that he had this thing that he thought of and he did the majority of the work on. And then he's able to like distribute it to people that he didn't even know that well. It was just cool to have this kind of old school, very tangible approach. And like, I won't lie. Like I went to a, you know, some sort of PTA thing or something at his school, and I was in the STEM room and I looked up and saw his zine tacked to the information board in the classroom. And I was just like, I was definitely a proud parent. I'm like the teacher tacked it up. It's there for everyone to see. It was, I don't know. I just thought it was really cool.
You're exposed to this stuff growing up, at least in terms of kind of computers and digital design or however you might characterize it. And then get me through university and some of the things that you did. You studied industrial design?
Yeah. So, I mean, I didn't have much exposure to design growing up. My parents are both basically like scientists by training. So experimenting and project-based stuff for sure, like growing up, but I wasn't exposed to necessarily design. I definitely loved to draw as a kid because my dad was in the computer world in the 80s. Like he had reams and reams of that white and green paper that used to feed through printers. It was like one long strip. So it was the best paper format. So I was just always drawing and always had, you know, access to those kind of tools, which was great. You know, did art in high school. And one thing my family loved doing was just sort of inventing crazy ideas, like especially my dad, but we would just, you know, talk about funny things and just ideas for inventions and stuff like that. So that side of it definitely was there growing up. And I remember doing some projects in middle school and high school that involved creating things, but I didn't know that as design, right? I just kind of knew that was like, you could invent things. And of course was involved in music and art. And, you know, I got into Virginia Tech, the state school that, you know, the biggest state school, and, you know, it was a good school for engineering. And so that's kind of what I applied for, is I thought those are the people that, you know, invented stuff. And then, you know, started an engineering program at Virginia Tech. Pretty quickly realized, especially first year engineering courses, like they're just, it's really trying to like weed people out. It's just like hardcore math and science. It's very not tangible in that first year. I was always like, well, if I get to senior year, that's when I get to build a solar race car or whatever. Like looking back, like for the way I am, like that would be just so sick to have to wait 3 years to kind of make something. And so, yeah, it wasn't until my second year I was in a engineering class and the professor, you know, I drew something, I sketched something out, and he was like, wow, that's great. You can do that. Usually only industrial designers do the drawing. That was the needle on the record moment for me. I'm like, wait, what? Who? Wait, what did you say? you know, and this is right when like Apple started like doing their big comeback, when they started producing like the lollipop colored computers, and Target just started doing designs. Like design was hitting the mainstream at that point, or at least physical design. So I definitely was starting to get a little more aware. And then hearing that, oh, I can do that. And luckily, really luckily, the school had an industrial design program in the architecture department. So I found a friend of a friend that actually was in it and toured the studio and absolutely fell in love. You know, I think especially like the space, you know, at that school, everyone had their own desk in the studio space, whether you're an architect or industrial designer, and everything was sitting out on their desks, like projects that were half finished and books and sketches and physical stuff everywhere. And even at the freshman level, you were making stuff, you know what I mean? So it was definitely at that moment realized like, oh no, this is where I should be. And I quickly switched over. Of course, it wasn't that easy. I got rejected the first time I applied to get into the program and they said, no, try again next year. And I was like, no way. Like, I have to do this. It's now or never. I'd already been there a year and a half or whatever. And I'd already taken a couple industrial design courses, just like without credit or whatever. So I got those professors to kind of vouch for me. And I kind of pushed my way into the program, which I guess is another quality I probably still possess of like sheer rugged determination, like to never give up, which has its major negatives as well as positives. Yeah. And so I had to do like a summer intensive studio where you were in studio 8 hours a day, every day throughout the summer to, you know, everyone did this that transferred in because you had to catch up. And I feel like that also informed work ethic and just completely immersed and obsessed with the topic. Because if you were willing to do that through your summer as a 19-year-old, you were pretty committed. I think what I realized by the end, though, and I graduated in 2002 because of the transfer thing, the economy was kind of on a downturn. And I feel like that was actually in some ways good for me because I realized like, you know, like I love making things. And obviously, like the act of doing industrial design is, you know, I really have a passion for it, but I'm mostly just interested in a job where I can be creative and a career where I can like create things or ideas or whatever. I just want to be creative. I could have ended up in a lot of different places and probably been very happy. And I think that's still why I'm so broadly interested in design. It's the act of coming up with ideas and bringing them to life that I'm really mostly excited about. I have a specific interest in product design, but you know, that's also why I'm professionally basically an illustrator as well. Like I just love the process of making something from nothing. But I did get a job, luckily, out of school, moved to Chicago for it, knowing nobody. I kind of always figured I'd be on the East Coast, you know, New York or Boston or whatever. And, you know, I got a job at Chicago and moved here and we fell in love with it right away and been here since.
Yeah. And were your parents cool with your pivot?
Yeah, no, my parents were supportive of it and they could see how excited I was about it. And I mean, my grades were obviously way better and I was bringing home work and was excited to talk about it. So I think they were instantly sold that this was something I was into. So yeah, moved to Chicago and just been kind of working for different agencies and firms and in different ways and freelancing and side projects and all those kind of things led up to when we worked together at Gravity Tank. I guess I went independent about 7 or so years ago, maybe 8, and took the show on the road. And yeah, just kind of a mixed hustle since then and doing different things.
When I was coming up with a concept for this show, like the idea of interviewing people who have taken non-traditional paths and left agencies to do their own thing, your work to me is this amalgamation of hustles of all kinds. You know, there's the brand that you have, but there's also like Creighton Berman, the designer and illustrator and facilitator. And some of those you promote widely, proudly. And then others you kind of do in what feels like the background. And I was always curious what the balance of that was and how, you know, how you took care of a family and had a studio on the backs of what felt like a handful of really successful like Kickstarter products. And so that always felt mysterious and really intriguing. And I just remember you when we were at Gravity Tank together, emphasizing the importance of the side hustle and even using that as a like a hiring criteria. I remember when we were like evaluating, you were like, well, you know, what does this person do outside of work? And I was like, who cares? And you're like, I do. Like, I want to know that they've got interesting things going on that will like filter back into the work that they do here. Like, I don't want them to just do this alone and not have like interesting creative things outside of work. And I'd never really use it as like a way to evaluate a candidate. And so for someone who has that commitment or work ethic, I'd love to hear your thoughts about that as it relates to the show and what I'm trying to do.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I was on Twitter Because I work by myself, I do spend a lot of time looking at Twitter because it feels like that's the water cooler. And I just saw someone post the other day, like a facetious tweet about, you know, they've seen like 10,000 articles about how being a father made me a better UX designer, about how being a runner made me a better UX designer, and about how cooking dinner made me a better UX designer. And this person was like kind of sick of it. And my knee-jerk reaction would probably be the same. Like, oh God, people, like, just live your life and don't always have to relate it back to your work. But then I kind of got almost defensive of it and wrote back to the guy. I was kind of like, well, I don't know. Like, if your job is designing experiences, every experience in your life should probably make you a better designer. You know, having other things going on in your life, having interests, having hobbies, or side hustles or whatever you want, however you want to classify it, I think it just makes you more interesting as a person. I guess I've always maybe over-prioritized having a lot of things going on in my own life. So I have Creighton Berman Studio, which is basically me and my output. You know, it always relates to design and design thinking and kind of storytelling and things like that. But it's, you know, tends to end in something that looks like illustration or animation or some sort of like visualization of an idea, right? In that business, I work with clients. And then I have Manual, which is the housewares brand, right? And where I'm creating products and trying to market these and build a brand and have that kind of modern conversation with my customers and make things and sell them and try to make some money. And then I was teaching as well, but luckily I've kind of been able to turn that down a little bit right now because it's just a lot to do all that and try and be, you know, a good father and good husband and around the house. And it's funny because while I had a full-time job, I was such an advocate of the side hustle or just having passions and other things you're doing and interested in. And now after almost 8 years of being independent, I'm trying to push myself to have more hobbies and things that don't have anything to do with the hustle. Like, you know, finish some of the novels that I have sitting next to my bedside or make some of that music that I've been noodling around in for years. So I'm realizing the value of unstructured time. Something I can't sell, something that won't ever be a Kickstarter, you know, or trying to at least not go that direction.
Yeah. When we met at Gravity Tank, you were on the product or the industrial design team. I was on the interaction team. And at some point you joined the interaction team. I was always a little jealous because I felt like there was the work that you were doing, and maybe you were frustrated by this, but you became like the guy who could render all the things. You were like the illustrated use case machine. And I felt like at a certain point you're like, you know, I can do more than right. Just do this, you know, like this is getting a little old. It's just me and a Wacom, like what's going on? And so all the things that you did that I'd hear about like on lunch or, you know, you were writing for or illustrating with regularity for publications and these things that I saw like, oh, that's real. Like I can go buy that magazine on the newsstand and see Creighton's work. And it just felt like, man, I want side hustles like that too. Like that.
Well, you did though, man. Cause you, I mean, when I met you, you had the t-shirt company. Maybe it was starting to like wind down at that point, but you were doing, it was a Good Night TV, right?
Right. Yeah.
And I mean, you DJed for a long time and you still do. So, I mean, give yourself some credit. You definitely, you had, and I think that's probably leaving out a few as well. Like you definitely had a few different things. You were multifaceted long before you met me.
Yeah, no, but I felt like some of the things that you were doing, they were really about building like a body of work or about like putting your talents or perspectives or something out. I don't know how much money you made on any of those, but I felt like I could tell that they were setting you up for your departure ultimately. And so I think that's maybe the distinction that I made is like, mine felt like one-off kind of things and yours felt like a steady beat of getting your name out there. And so when you finally left, I felt like, well, you've already sort of built up this reputation. There's things that you can point to in the world that like would prove this out, and you don't need a giant client list to demonstrate what you're able to do because you'd kind of already been doing it with some regularity.
That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, it's funny, like the grass is always greener, right? Because I think you're right. I think if I have a superpower or strength, it's just like I said, like sheer determination and like steady drumbeat forward. You know, I've talked to people before who kind of like their careers are marked by like large swings of like success and then like, you know, retreat and then find something else in success and then retreat. And I'm just like, wow, I don't know that at all. Like that contrast of, I feel like I'm just a slow and steady, like 2-degree incline upwards, like just keep producing work and things I want to do and keep pushing it forward. And this just keeps building up, right? Thinking about those ephemeral things that you mentioned, I'm kind of almost envious of that because it's like, I've never been great at like one-off events or short-term like creative output, it always tends to like want to be a series or want to be mass-produced. And that's why I mentioned before, like, I think my interest in design is more like an interest in creativity. It's like, ultimately, I think what I really love is mass production of ideas, whether that be like as a product launched as a Kickstarter, or whether that be like, you know, cartoons that get published in a magazine, or whether it's just like an Instagram feed of like ideas that keep growing. Like, I just love that mass communication, I guess, whether it be through product or drawing or whatever. Like, I get really excited about spreading ideas, I guess. I think I've always been somewhat resourceful that way, and I hope I can keep being resourceful. It's one of those existential questions as a middle-aged creator, you know, because I'm almost 40. It's like, you know, I definitely, a lot of my youth or younger years as a designer, in my eyes, are defined as being like resourceful and finding formats or clients or projects, and pretty early adopter to Kickstarter and things like that. Like, just like being open and jumping on things and trying them out early on. I feel like I had a lot of opportunities to do that and kind of find myself that way. You know, obviously as you get older, you get more set in your ways, and you know, I just want to make sure I'm not like, you know, 10 years from now, still kind of, you know, using the same tools and kind of approaching work in the exact same way. I mean, there's something to obviously having a body of work and a consistent voice, and that should grow and change over time, obviously. My main point is I've had a lot of opportunities to try a lot of different things out and still sort of build what I hope is sort of a singular point of view about the way I approach things. And I hope I can keep that up in the future.
I think it's as much of, you know, the things you say yes to and take on, and then the things that you turn down that helps refine that singular voice. And yeah, and I feel similarly around this notion of being outmoded, or, well, maybe there's another platform I should be using that I just don't know about, that an up and coming designer is already like maxing out, and I'm not even aware of this new space I could be putting work in, or a new tool I could be using. And yeah, on one hand, it feels like, oh no, like, I'm getting old. And then on the other hand, it's like, these things go in cycles, and I think it's about quality of work and the message or the idea behind the thing. And, you know, by any means necessary, like, use whatever tool or platform is fine. Like, don't let that stand in the way of like thrusting this thing out in the world.
I mean, the tools are the tools, right? And I think that's one thing I always like to remind myself about too. It's like, of course, when you're a younger creator, like, you're really into jumping around on different tools and trying things out, because you're just an open book. Like, you're just like, I want to try everything out, or, you know, at least that's the way I was. And as you get older, it's probably not realistic that you're going to keep up with the tools like a 25-year-old will, but you've got this experience and worldview that's much more refined. Like, your taste as a designer or creator is like much more refined because you've just created more work, right? You know, I don't mean refined like better. I just mean refined like you've done it a lot. So you kind of know how to approach work and how to bring it to life. And so I think that's one thing I have to remind myself, is like, that's your advantage as you get older, is that you have this path behind you that has kind of projected you. It's not so based on tools, but it's still, I mean, the reality is, like, especially in the age we're living in, is tools matter and tools affect the work. And So I think it's important to, if you're not the one keeping up with it, that you're associating yourself with those who are and collaborating. And I've always respected creators. I keep using that word, but I'm just, you know, just because I don't want to say artist or designer or whatever, because I think it's anything, who are able to age gracefully in their work. Like, right now, I joined up with a new studio, and the main leaser of the space is a muralist and a painter, and he's in his 70s, and he's been doing it. He's been in that space since the 90s, and he's been doing it for, you know, his entire career, as far as I can tell. And he's insanely talented, and, you know, he's basically my father's age, and it's just really inspiring to like see him doing things. And as far as I can tell, is he makes his money doing, you know, commercial painting jobs, like murals for the sides of buildings or corporate lobbies or whatever. But he also has a pretty rich, active artistic practice as well, where he's, you know, he's able to keep a diverse practice going. And that's obviously one of my goals too, as I keep going. And it's cool to actually have a few role models around that are like doing that, because it's hard to find, right? Like, a lot of people don't last in creative fields, or they, you know, move in specific directions that make them the most money, or, you know, whatever. It's a rare find. So it's inspiring to see that and be like, yeah, like, you know, this guy's living the dream, right?
Yeah. And staying curious and open-minded, and
totally,
you know, these are some of the qualities that our kids have, that if we can hold on to them as we go, I think we're better positioned to stay the way you're describing some of these folks. Ageless, timeless, of the moment, but able to draw on past experiences. Like, all of that to me is a really beautiful blend.
It's so inspiring, right?
Yeah. And so I'm curious, you And Emily already had Henry when you decided to depart from Gravity Tank and strike out on your own. Is that right?
Yeah. He was probably about a year old, I think, maybe 18 months.
What was it like when you found out you were having a kid? And part two of that is describe what went through your mind with regards to your work. And what does that mean for my career, my plans, the work that I make, where I'm headed next?
Right. Yeah, no, that's a great question. We've always known that we wanted to have kids. I mean, like way early on, you know, we're like 19 years old, just started dating, and we jump right into it, just talk about like the heavy stuff. And we both wanted to be parents. And that was one of those things that I think bound us early on. I mean, one of many, but like, you know, that we had a worldview that was really similar and we valued being a parent. And we didn't do it for a long time. I think we started having children when we were 30. You know, we met when we were 19. So it was a long time before we pursued that, but we were on the same page. So for me, it was never really a question of whether I wanted to or not. Definitely the reality is when the time was getting close and we were starting to talk about it seriously, there were definitely anxieties inside of me. And there still are about like, have I accomplished professionally or not even professionally, but creatively, like have I accomplished the things I wanted to accomplish by this age? And it's hazy to me now because being a parent sometimes gives hazy memories, but I seem to recall we definitely had some strong conversations around where I had anxieties around, well, I just haven't done X, Y, or Z yet. And I really want to do that before we start. And I think, you know, Emily was ready probably a little sooner than I was for it. So, you know, of course those conversations had stress to them. Luckily, and I don't think it was because of this, but I think at the same time, my wife, Emily, who was actually working at Gravity Tank at the time too, realized how much she loved food and decided to go to culinary school. So in some ways, her pursuit of her own creative passions kind of gave me almost like a little space to be like, okay, well, she's doing this. We're definitely not having a child while she's doing this. So this is my time to turn it up as well and start accomplishing. And I actually hadn't thought of it this way until now, but she was in culinary school for a year and she ended up quitting her job or, you know, leaving her job halfway through to really focus on it and take some gigs on. And she was going to school at night and coming home late and all kinds of stuff. So we had like a really varied lifestyle and she was pursuing and learning and just inspired us like crazy. So I was kind of doing the same thing and started doing more side projects at that time period. And like I said, I hadn't really reflected on this till now, but I think that was kind of a time for me to like really turn it up. And we did. And like, you know, that's kind of when like a lot of my side projects, illustration and product stuff started really happening. Only because it just felt like I was like, oh, look, we're going to have kids in the next couple of years. Like it's going to happen. And we did. Like she finished culinary school. And I think within 6 months, she was pregnant with Henry. So, but there was never like, at the same time, there was never like this frantic, like, I got to get this done or it's never going to happen thing. It was just, you know, I was turning 30. So there's obviously those kind of milestones of like, oh, wow, what have I done? You know, like I said, I'd always kind of wanted to be independent. That was sort of always my model from very early on with my father. And a lot of these things were kind of coming together at one time. So it was never like, I never really thought like I would not accomplish my creative and professional goals if we had children. I just knew that prior to children was very much easier, right? Because it's just one less responsibility, right? I think we had a condo at that point, so there's a mortgage responsibility. But beyond that, you just don't have that much responsibility. I mean, I was lucky and privileged enough not to have a lot weighing on me. I didn't have sick family members or lots of student debt or anything like that. So it's like, sort of like, you know, it's got to do this now. I guess I've always been pretty rational about it. So, you know, like while leaving my full-time job and having a life of sort of a mix of freelance and self-directed projects was my goal for a long time. There were a lot of false starts for at least 2 years before I left my job. There was like false starts of like, I thought I had this like somewhat reliable gig that I could pick up doing freelance work or doing a contract or whatever. And then they just didn't happen. And so there were a lot of false starts. And I think part of that, especially near the end, was because my wife was in school. And so like, you know, and especially when she left her job, like I was the sole breadwinner for a long time. And so that's a real thing. It's like a really real thing, especially when you start having children.
In terms of like its influence on like what you choose to take on and don't and the timing.
Yeah, it's a real pressure. It's like I don't want to throw us into destitution and be bankrupt. You know what I mean? So I definitely, there were a lot of false starts and it finally lined up when I had some conversations with some people in a few industries I was interested in and they were able to kind of say, yeah, I could imagine using you, you know, this many hours a week. So it kind of gave me a little bit of stability and I was still doing my own products on the side, but the reality is that's not going to support our lives. And so, you know, I definitely needed that freelance kind of stream of income to make sure this actually like could work. I always tell students, it's like, if you can find a skill that you can freelance or, you know, has high value and allows you to still have free time to pursue your passions that don't necessarily have high economic value yet, or maybe never will, but you're able to kind of do both and free up your time to do both. That's the dream, really. And that's kind of the situation I have, is work that generally can pay me well, and then I'm able to kind of take on projects that, you know, might need more time to be cultivated, and, you know, and who knows, some of the projects may never actually make a lot of money. But having that mix is, like, to me at least, that's the dream of being a creator that can do a bunch of different things. So Henry was born in October 2010, and then I left, went independent in the spring of 2011. The opportunities lined up. I had a couple projects that were about to drop. I had a gig that I really wanted to go to that interfered with a client meeting at my full-time job. And so that was it. It was like, okay, you have to pick between the two. And so I picked to go independent, and it was definitely a leap of faith. And I give Emily, like, a lot of credit for supporting me through that, because I'm very much almost to a fault, like, an optimist about things will work out. And so I was like, oh yeah, this will work. Like, I can make this work. And I had no idea how hard it would really be. And she, of course, was more of a pessimist about it and really running the numbers. But she trusted it enough that we did it. You know, so I was the sole breadwinner and went independent with a one-year-old. That's nuts to say now. Like, it's just nuts to say, but it worked, and it didn't work immediately. Like, it took some ramping up for sure, but there was definitely enough there to sustain, right? It doesn't always work out perfectly. And what I've learned is just being ready, like, recognizing the signs early that things aren't necessarily going the right way for my business, and reacting earlier is the key, and not holding on to that optimism for too long and being like, oh yeah, it's fine. It's kind of, something will land. You know, you got to act and react. And that's been an interesting balance. And honestly, for the most part, like, it's been positive and rewarding, and it's got its own unique challenges, but those are the challenges that I think suit me and make me happy.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that you should reflect and be kind to yourself in just that idea that, like, wow, that was nuts. Like, that was crazy timing. I had an almost 2-year-old, and I made this leap, and, like, 8 years later, to look back and be like, and it all worked, you know, like, it was hard and lean times, but it worked well enough that you did it again.
Like, right.
You had another kid in this mix.
Right.
And this time without the benefits that come with working for, you know, a full-time employer. And so,
yeah, that was a totally different experience, and positive and not so positive. Because when Henry was born, I had a full-time job, and I feel like I did my job, and I did it, you know, well, but, like, I was definitely exhausted. You know, our son didn't sleep through the night until he was, like, 18 months old. It was, you know, just brutal. And I was also freelancing a ton. When I was doing that illustration work for Dwell once a month, Dwell magazine. I have memories of being up just to ridiculous hours, and Henry would always wake up at, like, 2 a.m. and feed, right? And so I would just stay up until 2 to carry him into Emily. And, like, I don't know how I'm not a big advocate of, like, not sleeping. I think it's actually a really bad idea, but at that time, that's just kind of the way things worked out. I was just doing a lot on the side, and, you know, I had products that I was selling and shipping, and just stayed super, super busy. But, you know, I had a job, so, like, I had good health insurance. You know, I had a little bit of time off for paternity leave. You know, when Gus was born 3.5 years later, I had been independent for a while, and it was just a totally different ballgame. Like, luckily, the way things worked out, when he was born, and I think also when we moved into the home we're in now, I had projects that were, like, they were long enough term, and they paid well enough that I could just focus on those and work from home and not be putting in long days at the studio or traveling. So I was actually able to take a lot of time off during those time periods, which was awesome, and really be there. And it's not paternity leave, but it's the next best thing, right? It's, you know, paternity, set your own schedule, which was great. Unfortunately, there was a lot of stress leading up to, I remember when Gus was born, I had launched my first big Kickstarter, and it took all 30 days to get it funded. And it was just super high stress. I was going for $100,000. I'd never asked anyone for that much money before. Emily was still pregnant with him. But then when we actually were, like, and by we, I mean me, when I was fulfilling the project and shipping these thousands of coffee makers around the world and just all the logistics and manufacturing things you would assume have to do with that, like, he was born during that time period. So,
God,
you know, I got pneumonia within a couple of months of him being born, because I think I was just pushing it too much, and just too much stress and too much not sleeping because we have a new baby. And I got really sick. So that, I think that was a good moment of, like, reflection on, like, all right, I got to find a way to, like, not be so crazy. You know what I mean? Like, it's just too much. And I think I've gotten a lot better with that. Like, just the emotional hurdles of entrepreneurship, and mixed with, you know, the physical hurdles and emotional of having a family and keeping money flowing. We were lucky enough that I was doing well enough that Emily could stay home with the kids. And, you know, that was kind of a goal of hers as well, to be around as much as she could. So for 5 years, I was the sole breadwinner, and we were able to kind of make it work. It was awesome. It was great for our family. And she decided to go back to work. She kind of felt ready for it and wanted to take on some challenges that were outside of being home with two kids all day. But also, like, you know, it was just to be straightforward. Like, it was the one time where my business needed the help. I had huge anxieties about, I did not want her to have to get a job that she didn't love because I was doing the job that I loved and wasn't necessarily bringing in enough. That would have been huge guilt. Lucky for me, she found a perfect job for her and she loves it. And it's got this, you know, a level of flexibility that still affords us to be very present for our kids. And she gets off at 3 o'clock every day. So, you know, so she's able to be working now, and we're dual income family finally again for the first time in years. So that just feels really good. And for me, like, I think it doesn't relieve the pressure because obviously I still need to be making money, but because there's that mutuality, it feels like, okay, I've got a little bit of a backup plan now. Whereas before it was like no backup plan, just go for it kind of thing.
That helps offset financially and also just like the I think the emotional weight for either parent when it's just them bringing in the money for things.
And that's not, and I'm not trying to act like a superhero either. Like, I mean, being a stay-at-home mom is crazy hard, physically, psychologically, everything. So we both were like kind of all in our spaces. And I don't want to speak for her, but I feel like we've had conversations where we've looked back and be like, wow, that was intense. Intense for her in very different ways than it was intense for me. You know what I mean? It was like almost like we had complete opposite responsibilities, right? I feel like I'm a very present father. So it's not like I wasn't around for my kids, but still, like, I was 100% responsible for the money. She was 100% responsible for keeping these kids alive every day and fed and happy. And it's just, that's intense. I mean, obviously there's lots of challenges we're experiencing now, which are ones you're familiar with and millions of other double working parents are used to. We just hadn't experienced until the past few years, but there's obviously different stresses of time and things like that when both parents are working, but that singularity, at least that part, is different.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned earlier, when you total up the hours that you have FaceTime with your kids, where you're present and you're there at home, the first half is routine to get out the door. And the second half of that time is routine to get them to bed. And
yeah,
it feels very compressed. And I often pause and I'm like, I'm busting my ass to be able to pull all this off. But what that's really doing is keeping me from my kids. And like this weird, like cyclical thing is happening. Like I'm hustling in order to have to be able to take care of kids, but then I don't get like awesome amounts of time with them because I'm hustling. And like, that's not a lot, you know, like 40 hours a week. And if you total it up, you probably spend like 20 hours Monday through Friday, at least, with your kids.
Right.
And sometimes that difference, that ratio really gets me down.
Totally. Yeah, it bums me out. Like, I think a lot about that. Even in best cases, like we have a lucky scenario where like I'm oftentimes able to see them when school gets out, I'm home or I'm there at my studio or whatever. But yeah, the reality is there's just not a lot of time during the week and it's not quality time. Like there's probably like 30 minutes where it's chill breakfast. Like I'll always cook them breakfast or, you know, whatever. And then suddenly we're in like freak out mode and it's like trying to get a 4-year-old and 8-year-old to focus and get dressed and get out the door. And I'm yelling and getting upset. And it's just like not quality time, you know?
And no, it's like 0 to 100 real
yeah,
fast.
Yeah. And it's, you know, obviously the evening's a little better because they'll come home and they got a little time, but still it's like, after dinner, rush to bed, like that's just not quality time. So, I mean, just what it is. It's unfortunately, I mean, weekends are precious and days off are precious and it just reminds you. But I mean, even on a grander scale, like you really only know your kids this intensely from age 0 till, I don't know, 16, 17. And then they start drifting away, right? They start becoming their own people. They start hanging out with friends more, getting jobs. Maybe they go to college. Maybe they don't, but they move out. And it's just like, you're never going to know them as well as you do now, which is, I don't know, like,
yeah,
for some reason, it's heavy. Yeah. And like, I don't know, like I've talked to Emily about this before and she's kind of like, well, that's just the natural way. Like that's becoming an adult. But I don't know, I guess part of me hopes that we, with our kids, can still stay really close. And, you know, I'm not sure what your relationship is with your parents, but like, you know, we see some people who like, they want to hang out with their parents and like they'll go and like have a glass of wine together and like they just really enjoy each other and they spend a lot of time together. And like, you know, my relationship with my parents isn't really like that. And so Emily and I are kind of like, it'd be kind of cool if our kids want to hang out with us when they're older. You know what I mean? Like, even when I'm super frustrated with my kids now, I try to remind myself, like, this is number one, it's fleeting. Like, you know, they're going to grow up and this behavior will change, but also I'll miss it.
Yeah, man. I think through these scenarios, these sort of seasons of life all the time. And, it's really the only anecdote for the harried chaos is
right.
Is that reminder of like, oh shit, I can't squander this. Yes, it's super hard and you really are annoying. And I can't wait to just drop you off at school right now. But by tonight, we'll both be in a different mood and I'm going to want to read you like extra stories, you know, because I don't want our time to end. I'm curious to that point, are there specific tactical strategies, things that you do to preserve or protect either your own creative time and make sure that there's no growing resentment there, or in the inverse, make sure that you build in time? Because for people who don't do what you do, the nights and weekends are where they're getting that hustle time in. You know, they don't get to do that during the day. And so anything that you do to either preserve your creative time or defend time for Henry and Gus?
Man, I think time is one of the most interesting and tough things for me. Like, I think I'm really bad at time in general, like not just like time management, because I'm not great at that either, but just getting my head around how long it takes to do things and what things need their own time. And I don't know, like, I guess it's part of like living in the moment, which is something I value. And I love improvisation and impromptu and serendipity. Like, I just, nothing makes me happier than when like you're just walking down the street and something happens that just really worked out. And, you know, like when I travel, I love just like letting things work out. You know, the downside of that is like, yeah, sometimes days will pass. I'm like, oh man, I really have not gotten X done. And it just keeps slipping through the fingers and it's my own fault. And, I think that's my biggest challenge that I've got to get better on as I get older, is like keeping what I get energy from, which is unstructured, serendipitous stuff, but bringing some structure to it so that I don't miss out. Like in the mornings, I don't touch my phone like until I leave the house. So like it stays on my bedside table. I know, because I just don't have a lot of self-control. Like if it's around, I'm going to be peeking at it and then get sucked into something and I'm not being present for the kids. And this started early on, like when Henry was a baby, I was up at like, you know, 5 a.m. or whatever. And I would just find myself like scrolling through Twitter with a baby next to me and like, this is stupid. Like, why am I doing this? So I just stopped. And so like things like that, hacks like that, which, I mean, I hesitate to use the word, but trying to keep things within reach that matter. You know, I've got a bunch of synthesizers. I've been wanting to do stuff with this for years and I just haven't. And it comes down to like, you end up doing what matters to you. And if the stuff that's within reach is your phone on your couch and Netflix, like that's what you're going to go into because it feels good and it's easy. But if you put the phone away in the evenings, like plug it in and leave it somewhere so I don't get distracted by it. I'm not 100% great at this. In fact, probably not even 20% great at this, but I'm trying. And I'm trying to keep sketchbooks and novels within arm's reach. And just the past couple of weeks, I've tried to set up a studio in the basement. You know, and you can always say all the promised lands around the corner, but like I feel like once I get that basement thing set up and I have a mixer and everything's all right with the speakers and everything's kind of just ready to go, so there's no friction, I just walk down there after the kids go to bed and I just start making music, like I think that's going to really change things. Because I think it has for other things. Like when I have a sketchbook within reach and I just have an idle moment, I pick it up and I doodle or I draw something or whatever. And to me, that's sort of some of the key of having that headspace in a hectic life, is making sure that you set up some of the physical constraints to be advantageous to doing what you value, which for me is creative work.
I'm really glad you mentioned those, because, you know, on one hand, they seem so straightforward or small. And on the other hand, I think they really are the key. Like where we live now is the first time I've ever been able to have room enough to have more than like a computer and a chair.
Right.
I have my turntable set up. I have a drafting table for illustration.
It's awesome.
It's the first time I've ever had room to leave those things out and not have to like unpack my turntables and like clear off a desk and set them up. And like, I'm never going to do that. Just like you said, these tools have to be at the ready to remove any barrier, so that as soon as they go down, you can tiptoe off to the studio and not have to like plug 20 pieces of equipment in and fire it up and remember like how you wired the speakers the last time. Like you just get to sit down and make. And I love extending it to these other things. Like they're still pleasurable, like reading a book or sketching, but they're not attached to your device. And that's the problem. The books I'm trying to read are all the way upstairs on a bookshelf.
Yep.
And I spend all my time downstairs. So like, totally. Why isn't there a little pile of books downstairs?
And that's what I've been doing. I'm looking at it right now. I'm at home and I'm looking at a little pile of books. I've got novels from the library that I've got on our coffee table. And I've had to like actually like explicitly say this to Emily, like, because she would just be cleaning up and she would take the books up to the bedside table and put magazines out on the coffee table, because that's kind of a, from a decorating perspective, it looks better than a novel, like a paperback novel, right? But I had to be like, no, I'm actually leaving these down here on purpose. Like, if you don't mind, I really want to keep these novels within eyesight and this sketchbook. it really does make a difference to me with children and, you know, having a job as a designer or a creative. Yes, I think it is always hard to try and find clear headspace, you know, and be creative and find that space. And I took it for granted when before kids, like how easy it would have been to do that. It wasn't until there was some urgency placed on me and my time got more precious, I think, that I really truly took advantage of the time to actually like act on ideas. You know, and I'm lucky, like you said, like I've got, you know, a studio and I'm able to kind of do some of that creative work during the day. But sometimes the realities of running a business gets in the way of that. So it's like, I think you're totally right. Like a thing I've got to stay mindful of myself is like making sure I have creative time where I'm unstructured for ideas, or whether it's, or it's really well structured and ready to go for creation. I think those are two really important points, because really clear distinctions are going to help you focus and be a better parent, be a better husband, be a better creator.
Yeah. You can't make time, you know, and people are like, oh, I got to make time. I'm like, nah, dude, you get 24 hours. You don't make time. You know, you have to carve it out. There's no like, yeah, I got to look for some time for that. I'll tell you exactly where it is. It's in your calendar. Like there's no looking for time. Like it's only carving it out, putting these boundaries and saying like, no, this is my time. Or like, no, this is not going to be interrupted by anything. This is going to be kid time. And being just weirdly rigid about that stuff, I think, is the only way to really protect it.
Yeah. I mean, and it's little things like, you know, for us, family dinner is really important. That is family time. You know, if a client needs to take a call, I'm like, sorry, I'm not available. Stuff like that. Like, I think that's just really, really important. And we do that. And a lot of people do that. But it's like, yeah, doing that same thing for your creative time. And I don't think I really do that. I probably should. You know, every Monday, I need to go to a coffee shop and sit and sketch in a sketchbook for 2 hours straight. Like, when was the last time I've done that? I don't know. It's like undisciplined discipline, right? Like, the whole idea is I need time to explore. I honestly can say I don't give myself enough time to explore anymore. And that's one of my anxieties. You know, how do you get ideas? If you don't give yourself influence and time to explore, I'm not used to having to like be so rigid about that. But you're right. Like, if you don't, it's just not going to happen.
Yeah. But I think what you said about not having a lot of time has made me really productive and really efficient. And I'm also going to be kind to myself and know that like that version of making with its weird constraints and stuff isn't going to be ideal or the way I used to do it when I had, you know, quote unquote, all the time in the world. But it's going to be a step towards solidifying that idea or being generative or exploratory. And I'm not going to beat myself up about that. I'm just going to take advantage of this, you know, this 15 minutes here, or this hour and a half here, or whatever I've kind of carved out.
And I'm not trying to dispense advice to other fathers or parents that are listening to this. Totally. But like, I feel like also like you have to recognize that like your existence in this world communicates or it influences your point of view. And your point of view is ultimately what makes you distinct as an artist. That makes the work you create only yours, because it's your unique point of view. The fact that you don't have a whole lot of time, you have responsibilities, your work will be uniquely influenced by that. I'm a big proponent of not seeing as a disadvantage that you have a family to your creative work. You know, it just colors it in a way. You're doing more with less time. You're probably making work that's a little bit different than someone who doesn't have that worldview that you have. And just, it's just, that is what it is. And, you know, you're just more direct and that's just the way it is. It is your reality though. So you can either create within your reality or not create at all. And I would choose to create within reality.
Yeah, that's actually really good advice. And I'm glad that you said it. I'm glad that you said it because I need to hear it.
Well, yeah. And all of this is me reminding myself too. I guess the best thing would be if you had no responsibilities in your life, you were just you in a big, beautiful studio, and it was just you and your creative work. But like, that sounds vacuous, right? To me, it's like, it doesn't sound realistic, because even if you choose not to have children or a partner, like you still came from a family, you still have friends, there's still people who care about you and who you might need to care for at some point in their lives. And so like responsibilities, they always exist. And the idea of creating without any responsibility at all is ridiculous. So I think it's just up to you to like balance the responsibilities you have with the creative goals you have, and then just keep moving towards what seems like a positive direction.
Yeah, I like treating it the way you're describing. Like, it isn't an end state. Like, there is no done version of great parenting / great maker. It's just a thing that hangs sometimes within reach and sometimes so far away you barely see it. That's the idea maybe that gets you through it, is knowing like, I'm never going to do that. Like, I'm never going to get to that point where I'm like, cool, all creative accomplishments done.
If you're not curious, yeah, I guess you are done. But that seems antithetical to like being a creative person is you are always moving and these new things pop up. And I mean, it's the same with parenting. Like, it's like if parenting were figured out, like then we would just like, you just plug in and do it.
Yeah. Yeah. The number of times lately that I've caught myself, even just like certain ways that I phrase something or little, just like a little, you know, speech pattern or tick that my dad does.
Yeah.
It is profound. I mean, some of these are just, they're literally just like a sound that like I'll make when I'm exasperated at or something, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh my God, that's the same sound my dad used to make. And it's like, I'm not mad at it. I'm not like, oh yeah. I'm just taking note. Like, wow, that is weird. Like that's just somewhere in there. My brain was like, oh yeah, do this, you know,
yeah.
as a reference. It's just like, it's bizarre.
Nature nurture, man. It's crazy. Yeah. It's amazing. And I think we're lucky that we had, I think fairly good upbringings and stable and loving. And so hopefully the stuff that surfaces is mostly positive, worst case embarrassing. But I mean, like, you know, there's lots of people who have really tough things that resurface and, you know, even in my own life, like there's definitely things that like when I see myself doing, and sometimes it takes Emily reflecting it back on me to see it. I'm like, oh yeah, like I recognize that from my parents. And yeah, I'm just defaulting to that. Like it's just what I know. And it's so hard to like change that behavior. Cause you were raised in it, you were a kid, you know, it's like not to put more weight on ourselves, but it's like when you have that realization that like, wow, like the stuff I absorbed from like age zero till sometime in my teens, like really influenced me that I'm still doing it now at almost age 40. It's like, oh wow. That means like everything I'm doing right now in front of my kids is totally getting soaked in.
Yeah. Last question, man. And I'll let you go. Does being a designer, a maker, an artist make you a better or a worse dad?
I don't know if it matters. No, it definitely matters. But in some ways, like I wanted to be a dad, like before I really was a designer, you know, I mean, obviously it's a big part of my life, personal identity and all those kind of things. But to go back to what we talked about way early on, like you got a job, you just do it and you come home. Like maybe that makes you a better father if you're able to like just completely disconnect from your job and you're just not thinking about it at all. And you're just like present. But I guess on the flip side, being someone who has passions and interests and isn't just defined by being a parent, but is defined by a multitude of things, including authorship and creating your own work, that gives a better or gives a interesting perspective to your kids that they have the ability to create and make things themselves and makes them self-assured and confident and creative. And so I don't know, man, I'm going back and forth. I think it's both. I think it makes me, angsty and distracted and flighty. And, you know, there's all kinds of little negative things that maybe come from being my version of a creative person and a father. But I'd like to think the positive way outweighs the negative. I still very much provide I think we both provide a very quality upbringing for them and a lot of love and a lot of attention and support. And yeah, I'm also pursuing a lot at once and busy and, but I want them to be a part of it too. So they get to see it. Having a creative set of parents is just the influence they have. That's their reality growing up. And that's what they're going to bring to the next generation is that perspective that they had. I think in the end, it's good. I think it's good. It's unique. It's different. Yeah. I don't think I really answered that question, but I feel like it's got my head spinning now.
Yeah, it's a good one. It's a loaded question. It's how I've ended every interview. So it's always funny to hear, you know, different takes on it. Man, I'm really glad we had a chance to chat. I'm glad this worked out for our calendars.
Totally. I could keep going for another 2 hours. I mean, I love this topic just as a topic to talk about. Basically, the two things I spend all my time on is is design and kids.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Dadwell Podcast. If you were inspired by what you heard, please take a few minutes to write a quick review on iTunes. As a first season podcast, this helps a ton, and it would mean a lot to me. Dadwell is on Twitter, Instagram, Medium, and all the other relevant social networks, so visit dadwell.co to find links to all of them. While you're there, You can also subscribe to the Dadwell newsletter and even cop some fresh Dadwell merch. Additionally, you can support this project by becoming a patron via patreon.com/dadwell. That's patreon.com/dadwell. Thanks again for listening. My name is Antonio Garcia, and we'll talk again soon. Cheers.